Our sun is headed into solar maximum, the period of greatest activity in its solar cycle. My name is Troy Klein, and welcome to the new podcast series called Space Weather Living History. During this series, you'll hear directly from the people who for years have been studying the evolution of space weather, how we make observations, and our capabilities to predict space weather events. Now, every 11 years on average, our sun reaches a peak period of activity called solar maximum. That's followed a few years later by a period of quiet called solar minimum. During solar maximum, there are many sunspots, solar flares, and coronal mass ejections, all of which can affect communications and technology here on Earth. Now, the energy from those solar blasts can disrupt radio communications, upset electrical power systems, damage satellites and change their orbits, cause navigational equipment to make mistakes, and even endanger astronauts walking in space. The effects from these solar storms can be far-reaching. In fact, they can have impacts throughout our entire solar system. These conditions are what we refer to as space weather. Sound exciting? Let's get right to the next interview.
I'm Chris Russell, and I'm a professor of space physics at the University of California, Los Angeles. And I've had the fortune to be involved in a lot of the early discoveries after the beginning of the space age. My primary area of research interest is the physics of magnetized plasmas, especially flowing plasmas. I'm interested in dynamos and how the magnetic fields of the solar system are generated. I'm interested in reconnection, which is a process whereby magnetic fields get coupled together and enable the transfer of energy from one region to another, and they also can enable the annihilation of magnetic fields and the release of that magnetic energy into other forms of energy. I'm interested in the formation of magnetic ropes. These are twisted bundles of ropes, especially ropes that can twist in such a way as they're self-balancing. So they push outwards and pull inwards at the same time and form just a rope, very much like a rope that you might tie something up with. Okay. I'm interested in magnetic barriers and boundary layers. They enable the transmission of both force and pressure to various regions in the plasma, like the Earth's magnetosphere being pushed on by the solar wind. I'm interested in shocks where there's a nonlinear interaction. The shock is a very strong wave. It heats the plasma and slows the plasma down and compresses it and is a very efficient way of energizing particles. I'm interested in waves themselves, the smaller the linear waves that will interact with the plasma, heat the plasma, scatter the plasma, and cause a lot of dissipation that is important to the space environment.
Now this, you may have actually already touched on this second part of the question about what do you like about it, if there's like a personal interest that you take in some of these areas.
If you say what was my involvement in all of those things, each one of them I've done a little bit of work on and pushed the field in a little way. So I feel some involvement in each one of these topics, but I, just like I have a couple of children, and I try not to favor one over the other, I'm interested in all of them. Well, I was very fortunate at the time that I graduated. I got my bachelor's degree and I just applied to the government for a summer job. I said, you know, you got this program for summer jobs for college students, just put me someplace. Well, they put me on a space program, and so my first summer job was studying solar radio waves from an ionospheric satellite that could also receive the radio emissions from the sun. So I got to learn about solar physics right from the get-go when I got my bachelor's degree. I then left, you know, after my summer job, and I went off to UCLA where I was going to major in just ordinary physics, maybe high-energy physics. But I got interested in space by my summer job. So when I got to UCLA, I looked around and I said, is anybody here involved in the space program? And I found a professor who was in geophysics rather than the physics department. And then I transferred over to geophysics, and I became a graduate student with Professor Holzer. He was involved in the OGO series of satellites, that's the Orbiting Geophysical Observatories. And they had just launched the year before the first of the OGOs, OGO 1, aptly named. And I got a chance to work on that particular spacecraft with some other graduate students who are already in the group. I was the third student, so I actually got to work on OGO 3. Now, in those days, they were the glory days of space, because we were launching an OGO spacecraft every year, okay? So when the first one had a problem and spun up when it was supposed to be three-axis stabilized, they just, you know, they said, okay, what went wrong? And then they fixed it on the next one. The next one worked better, and when that got to a failure mode, figured out what went wrong, and they fixed that on the next one. So each one was better than the other. So I got number three. That introduced me to the magnetopause, then the bow shock and the outer magnetosphere, and also the waves within the magnetosphere. So I also felt that I was especially blessed because I got to work on an eccentric orbiting spacecraft that went way out. There were two types of OGOs. They were a polar circular orbit and then an eccentric orbit. And if you were working on an eccentric orbiter, you got to go through every region of the magnetosphere. So so we went out into the solar wind, we went into the bow shock, we went into the magnetosheath, the magnetopause, the outer magnetosphere, and in the tail. And so we got to explore all of the various regions of the magnetosphere where things were happening, and then we got a better sort of perspective of the whole magnetosphere than somebody who is just in one little spot and had to understand one little piece of the system. So I always felt blessed by that experience. So I like odd numbers now. Then finally, after I graduated, I changed jobs just ever so slightly. I had been working on a search coil magnetometer on the spacecraft, and I switched to a flux gate magnetometer, which would measure the entire Earth's field. And so I got a chance to do a few things that we weren't able to do with just the search coil magnetometer. And in particular, we started looking at the motion of the magnetopause, and that led us to understanding the effect of the interplanetary magnetic field on the magnetosphere, and got me into studying the process we call reconnection. So the erosion of the magnetosphere is a situation where the magnetic field in the interplanetary medium, in the solar wind, comes up to the Earth, and it's southward, and the southward field is opposite of the Earth's magnetic field, and it reconnects or joins or annihilates the Earth's magnetic field. Then the magnetopause, because it's been eaten away by this anti-parallel field, moves inward. People had a hard time with that. They could understand pressure pushing the magnetopause in, but they didn't understand erosion. So there's a little bit of paradigm changing sort of friction there. People do not like to have their paradigms changed on them, and they resist as long as they can until they find out that this new paradigm explains more than the old paradigm did. Then I got into the semi-annual variation of geomagnetic activity. There was a whole bunch of silly ideas about why the aurora and geomagnetic activity was stronger at the equinoxes than it was at the solstices. They didn't make good physical sense to me, but I understood that there was this erosion process associated with reconnection, and I figured out how that might end up being modulated by the time of year, just the pointing of the Earth's dipole would do it. So I came up with that, and that got me a little bit more notoriety. And then there was another phenomena, the ring current that also was modulated by reconnection. So we explained how geomagnetic storms were just a process in which the coupling with the solar wind became greater for a period of time. Energy flowed into the magnetosphere and then gradually decayed with time. And you could explain it with just a few simple parameters, so how geomagnetic storms worked. So that got us a little bit more notoriety. I thought, well, you know, I was about 29 years old. What was I going to do with my life? So I sent a proposal into NASA to build a couple of magnetometers for a new spacecraft called ICE, the International Sun-Earth Explorer. And there are two spacecraft in the same orbit. And that's really very useful, co-orbiting spacecraft, because the magnetosphere is a very dynamic place. And the magnetopause is moving in and moving out, moving in and moving out. The bow shock does the same thing. And if you could just measure how fast these boundaries were moving back and forth, then you could figure out how thick they were, because we didn't know on the OGO spacecraft, which is just one-at-a-time spacecraft, how fast these boundaries were moving. We made some models, but it wasn't as good as actually measuring it. And so that was good. NASA said, sure, Chris. So I became a magnetometer PI. And sure enough, there were a whole bunch of things that were unexpected. Whenever you do something new, you might get the explanation for what you were expecting, but sometimes a whole bunch of new things come up. And in this particular case, we found flux ropes. These were essentially bundles of magnetic field rolled up that were on the magnetopause, and we see those on Mercury. We see them not only on the Earth, but we also see them at Jupiter. So they're a common magnetopause phenomena, and they're associated with reconnection. But we didn't necessarily solve it perfectly the first time. We just understood its general terms. It's still being worked on, even today, new models or at least old models are being tested, and it looks like maybe it's multiple reconnection points on the magnetopause simultaneously. I wasn't satisfied with just sending in one proposal. The next year I sent in another proposal to study Venus, and when we got to Venus, we saw flux ropes again, but Venus didn't have an intrinsic field, so that puzzled us somewhat. Then we started to understand the macroscopic cause of these geomagnetic storms that we'd explained in terms of energizing the magnetosphere. We found out that the sun was doing something, making magnetic clouds, and these magnetic clouds also were wrapped up in ropes, so that the sun was sending out giant magnetic ropes at the Earth, and that was what was causing these storms. So magnetic ropes in a lot of forms, from the sun, in the Venus ionosphere, and also at the Earth's magnetopause, have influenced my thinking and my research quite a bit. Okay, let me take you back to 1908 when we discovered that the sun was magnetic. Now, I wasn't around at that particular time, but it was a very important time for my research because it helped explain to the community why the sun does influence the Earth's magnetic field. And it's the interaction of the solar magnetic field with the Earth's magnetic field that allows us to have all the beautiful aurora and other phenomena that occur on the sun, or occur on the Earth because of the sun. it was very controversial and very difficult to understand because people did understand a little bit about plasmas and especially magnetized plasmas and could not understand one particular important point, and that is how fast the sun can release that energy. The sun can build up the energy in its magnetic field with its internal dynamo and building up magnetic constructs on the surface, but it has a way of getting rid of that energy in a hurry and then launching it off towards Earth, and that became a very controversial subject. There were a couple of people in the field. One was Giovanelli, an Australian researcher, and another was Jim Dungey, who became his postdoc after Jim Dungey's graduation from college, or getting his PhD in England. And so Jim went off to Australia, joined Giovanelli, and they started looking at what process could launch this energy quickly. And they came up with neutral points and centered their study around the physics of magnetic regions in which the magnetic field went to zero and you had anti-parallel fields coming into this point. That turns out to be what I consider the very breakthrough idea. However, other people like Sweet and Parker were trying to get rapid energization out of sheets of anti-parallel magnetic field rather than points of anti-parallel fields. And they were unable to get the same speed as that Giovanelli and Jim Dungey were aiming at. However, eventually we understand it much better now, and we understand that geometry of the situation is all very important. Now, there was one other important breakthrough that Dungey is associated with, and that was realizing how that process of reconnection that they were studying because of its solar implication could be used to power the aurora at Earth. And Jim tells the story that he was invited to give a seminar in Paris, and he was sitting there on the, a coffee cafe on the, on the streets of Paris, and trying to think what the heck he could say in this seminar. And he realized that the anti-parallel fields, when they reached the Earth's magnetosphere, would set up a circulation pattern. They would reconnect and with the Earth's magnetic field, transport flux over the pole, and come in and cause circulation from a neutral point in the tail that would cause the flow to come back at the magnetosphere and set up this overall circulating pattern of flows within the magnetosphere. And so the rest is history, but it took many years for Dungey's ideas to be accepted. Dungey was a person who had very, out of the mainstream ideas, and he wasn't always appreciated because of his personality and because of his, odd way of thinking out of the mainstream. And so it was many years, that was 1961. I came along in doing my work in this particular area in the regime of about 1968 to 73 approximately. And we knew the name that Dungey had been using for this effect, reconnection. But when we started publishing papers in support of these ideas that were consistent with his ideas, we didn't use reconnection. And in fact, embarrassingly enough to say, we didn't even reference Dungey. But eventually, we proved Dungey to be right. One of the first concepts that supported Dungey was the erosion of the magnetopause. It's where the interplanetary field turns southward, the solar wind pressure doesn't increase, but this magnetopause moves in because flux is being transferred to the tail. Let me say a little bit about the erosion of the magnetopause and how that supported Dungey's model. We found that when the interplanetary field turned southward, opposite the direction of the Earth's magnetic field at the forward magnetopause, that the two fields merged or joined together, and that eroded or pulled flux from the day side to the night side. And then later we found how that returned. Now, people didn't accept that right away because they understood understood that pressure could move the magnetopause, but they didn't understand how this magnetic force, that magnetic stress that was being applied to the magnetopause would work. Fortunately, there were some bright theoreticians around who were able to understand that and explain it. But that erosion of the magnetopause was a key observation for us that Dungey was right. I'm a little embarrassed to say that we did not give Dungey the proper credit at that particular time. His ideas were known, but they weren't very much accepted. But eventually, we got Dungey the credit that he deserved. Then the spacecraft, it was OGO-5, which we were using to study the erosion of the magnetopause. 6 months after it was on the day side, it was on the night side of the Earth, because the Earth goes around the Sun and the orbit stays fixed in inertial space. And so we started to measure what was happening in the geomagnetic tail. And we could then see that these dynamic features were also happening in the tail of the Earth, that were returning the flux from the tail that had been transferred to the tail into the Earth's magnetosphere. That gave us the idea that there was a neutral point, like Dungey had predicted, but that neutral point was much closer to the Earth. Now, we call that neutral point now a plasmoid, but that's what basically the plasmoid is centered around or formed by the neutral point that Dungey had proposed many years ahead of time. That was very important in putting together an overall phenomenology of what we call a substorm, and that's the standard explanation of the substorm today. And in fact, I think at the present time I can say that there's very little controversy now about the origin of a substorm, that the people held out until the recent Themis mission, but when the Themis mission went off a few years back now, then the opposition to that finally died away. But the acceptance of reconnection at the front of the magnetosphere took not just the magnetic energy evidence, but it also took us to demonstrate that there were flows of the plasma, so that the nice thing that the icy spacecraft had, that the OGO spacecraft didn't have, were detectors that could look along the field line and see the plasma that was accelerated flow away from the equatorial regions. And when the flow measurements came, then we were brave enough to use the word reconnection in the title of our article. And so the Nature paper that discovered these flows said evidence for reconnection in the title, and we were brave finally. We had won in the paradigm fight.
I hope you enjoyed the Space Weather Living History podcast brought to you by NASA's Sun Earth Days program. You can learn more about the Space Weather Living History project on our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov. And don't forget to join our growing community of Facebook and Twitter fans for the latest information and facts about the new Sun Earth Day themes. For all other details about these programs, including information about our past Sun Earth Days themes, be sure to visit our website at sunearthday.nasa.gov.